expensive to repair, arrange to donate it to KPFK. It's easy for you, pickup is free, and it could be worth hundreds of dollars in support. Thanks in advance, and here is how to get started. Go to kpfk.org/cars or call 877-573-5288. That is 1-877-KPFK-AUTO. And learn more.
KPFK 90.7 FM, Los Angeles.
Welcome to Rising Up with Sonali, an independently produced, subscriber-supported program syndicated to radio stations, free speech, TV, and podcast platforms. On this show, you'll hear solutions journalism for social justice, fueling action, not despair. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar, host and executive producer. This week, we'll examine the latest situation in the U.S.-Israel war on Iran and prospects for peace and justice via the nation's anti-war movement. Iranian-American journalist Negin Oliai, editor-in-chief of Truthout, will be my guest. Then we'll turn to Saqib Bhatti, co-founder and executive director of the Action Center on Race and the Economy, who's working with the May Day Strong Coalition. He'll explain plans for a massive May 1st national mobilization and how it builds on the No Kings formation. Finally, we'll feature a new documentary called Steal the Story, Please, that centers the pioneering independent media outlet Democracy Now! My guest will be its host, Amy Goodman herself. That's coming up in just a moment. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar, host and executive producer of Rising Up with Sonali, an independently produced, subscriber-supported program nationally syndicated to radio stations, free speech, TV, and podcast platforms. Our interviews are available to subscribers at risingupwithsonali.com. U.S.-Iranian talks over the weekend failed, resulting in the Trump administration imposing a unilateral blockade of ships heading to Iran. Iranian officials say U.S. officials deliberately sabotaged peace talks when they were just, quote, inches away from a deal. Donald Trump recently threatened to obliterate Iran's entire civilization, an openly genocidal threat. Meanwhile, Israel, on whose behalf the U.S. appears to have launched its war on Iran, has obliterated entire villages in Lebanon. Joining me to discuss how and when this war will end, particularly with respect to the U.S. anti-war movement, is Negin Oliai. She is the editor-in-chief of Truthout, an independent media organization that provides reporting and commentary on social justice issues, and she's been writing about this. Welcome to the program, Negin.
Thank you so much for having me.
So first, let's talk about the fact that we seem to have a president who has launched a war on behalf of another nation, Israel. At least that's what a lot of evidence suggests, and seems to change their view every other day and make threats that they don't follow through with and launch talks that they deliberately sabotage. It seems as though Trump simply wants to have a war to either distract from domestic issues at home or to bluster about because he is, you know, a wannabe dictator. Why do you think we're even in this war to begin with?
You know, that's such a, it seems like it should be such a straightforward and simple question, and yet it's completely not. I do think that you're seeing that after years of no pushback against genocide in Gaza perpetrated by Israel, powers that be are realizing that you can do some pretty violent stuff without getting any kind of international pushback. And so I think that's one of the reasons why we're in this war. To your point, one thing I don't want to downplay is the decades and decades that politicians on both sides of the aisle in the United States have spent demonizing Iran, pushing against any kind of diplomacy, against any kind of deal. So there is a groundwork that is set way, way, way before this war began or before it was ever conceived. And it goes beyond, you know, it goes beyond what Israel could say or do. This is we've been primed for this for a long time. And this is one of the reasons why I think pushing back against this kind of rhetoric, wherever it rears its head, it's such a crucial part of having an anti-war movement. We can't let other countries be talked about the way that Iran has been talked about for decades now.
I think you bring up such an important point about the fact that we've had a situation where the executive branch has been able to do damage, wreak destruction on, you know, huge numbers of people without much consequence. You can say that goes back to September 11th. And of course, in the past, Congress has been involved in bigger, wider, longer wars. And this lack of consequence is a failure of American democracy, is it not? Which suggests that the responsibility really lies with us.
Yeah, I mean, I would definitely agree. I mean, you have brought up in this one question several really crucial points, which is what have we seen in terms of any kind of consequence for the war in Iraq, right? In which the U.S. invaded under false pretenses, occupied for years, you know, so I think it's crucial when we have these moments where we see these massive mistakes that lead to massive loss of life happen, that we stop and pause and take those seriously. And I worry that we're not even seeing that right now. I mean, as you mentioned, we saw Trump make a genocidal threat less than a week ago, right? It was less than a week ago. And I already feel like it's been erased from headlines in mainstream corporate outlets across the country. So I do think that it's on everyone in the U.S., it's on the media, it's on politicians, it's on people to make sure that we are clear with our voices that this is not okay, right? We do not want threats of genocide being made in our name. We do not want to spend, you know, $1.5 trillion on a military budget. We do not want to do so many of these things. We do not want to be bombing kids' schools, elementary schools, you know? So I think all these things, like we need to look internally too, whether that's the anti-war movement, whether it's politicians again, whether it's those of us in media, and just people who live in this country.
One of the things that seems to have just gotten lost in the mix and with lack of media coverage is the fact that Trump in early April openly said it's not possible for the U.S. to pay for Medicaid and Medicare and daycare because we're fighting wars. And apparently the clip of Trump saying that was taken off of the White House's social media. But that is such an important equation, right, Nagin? And I'm wondering if you can hone in on that we can't have these nice things because we're doing these other terrible things.
I just don't know who in the United States would decide, I want my money going toward, doing research for these. There's, for example, a new missile that they use in this war called the PrSM missile. It's from Lockheed Martin, and it was used in a strike that killed 21 people. I believe the youngest person who was killed was a toddler, and it's basically a missile that it spreads these like steel pellets, these tungsten pellets around before it explodes, and so it can do this maximum impact. That's what our money is going toward instead of daycare. You know, it's going to kill kids who are going to daycare rather than providing daycare. I think that is just so wild. But at the same time, I think it's incumbent on all of us to remember that first of all, to center the humanity of the people who are being bombed too, and realize that we don't want this in our name because it's a bad thing in the first place. And just to that point, I am thinking of Marco Rubio making a similar quote, around, I think the same week that Trump made that one, about how, you know, isn't it a shame that Iran has used all of its money toward making missiles and towards militarism. This is not the exact quote, obviously, instead of providing for its people. It's just like, where is the self-reflection? And again, I think that that's on all of us.
I missed that.
He's been really, there's been a few quotes from him throughout this course of this war, but it just makes me think like, what, who's approving you saying this? Because anyone who thinks for more than 5 seconds understands what's so messed up about that.
So we recently had a big mobilization nationwide, a historic mobilization with the No Kings rallies. It was the third No Kings gathering since the past year, since Trump has been in office. But the latest one took place in late March, and something on the order of 8 to 9 million people marched. And there was some valid critique from some folks on the left who were saying, well, there wasn't an explicit opposition to this brand new war that we've just been thrown into. And how could you have any kind of resistance to the Trump administration when you don't explicitly condemn this crazy war? And I'm wondering if you have any thoughts on that.
I have so many thoughts on it. I mean, I completely understand. I understand the critique. I think it's a reasonable one to make. You did see that there was some, you know, from the organizers of the protests, there was some pushback against the war, but it was not, you know, it was not so much of a direct, it was not as direct as I think it could have been. And I think that's where a lot of the pushback was coming from. And I understand it. You know, I'm Iranian American. I have family in Iran. It hurts. I mean, it's painful for me to go to places and see people just going about their lives and knowing that what my family is going through with money that, you know, I pay in taxes is going to go to bomb the bridges near them, you know, the oil depots near them. So it's, I think it's, again, a human, like, as a human, I think it's an urgent issue for us to all bring up when our money goes towards militarism. But also domestically in the US, foreign policy is one of, if not the most undemocratic spaces in US politics, right? So you're seeing this kind of really unprecedented polling that shows how unpopular this war is. And you don't really see that reflected in the way that the political class is acting around it, right? So you saw some effort at a war powers resolution, but it's been kind of weak. You've seen some Democrats, for example, say that, oh, Trump is chickening out and that's why he was agreeing to a ceasefire, as if people don't want a ceasefire, you know? So I think for people who are going to a No Kings protest, where the point is, you know, ostensibly to be caring about democracy, like, let's look at one of the most democratic, the least democratic places we have, and that's foreign policy.
And I think foreign policy also is one of the most bipartisan aspects of politics, right? Generally, Democrats and Republicans have agreed to more than they've disagreed on. Like, they tend to disagree on domestic issues so much so that if a Democrat is for it, then the Republican leader must be against it, or just on principle. But they tend to want to put aside their differences when it comes to foreign policy and join in the warmongering. Unfortunately, it's rarely in the direction of peace. They've also been tremendously bipartisan on supporting, unconditionally supporting Israel in its many wars and long-term apartheid and genocide regime against Palestinians. But maybe that might be changing a little bit in the past year or two with this latest Israeli post-October 7th war on Gaza. And you brought up the issue of Israel. And you know, of course, Israel is very much involved in the war on Iran and the expanding war in Lebanon. Is there, as far as you can tell, any kind of partisan break when it comes to Israel, when it comes to the Israel lobby as well, impacting politics here?
That's a great question. And I think the answer is TBD. We don't know yet. We're seeing a break, certainly from voters, right? And actually, we're seeing it from the right as well as from the left. So again, if you're interested in democracy, you should read The Room and see how strongly the American populace feels against this war in particular, and how quickly tides are shifting against Israel. Do we have that in terms of a party level or in terms of the political class level? I don't think we're there yet. I think it's changing a little bit. You're starting to see that there are some people who are potentially interested in running in 2028 for the Democratic nomination for the presidential, you know, for the presidential race, starting to say, you know, they're starting to to temper their language around their, you know, their support for Israel. Maybe some are even going so far as to say that they won't support funding for weapons, including what they call, like, quote unquote, defensive weapons. I don't think, which I think is just a completely absurd framing for a weapon to be defensive. Even if you're talking about missiles, it's like Iron Dome. It's still missiles. It still allows states like Israel to, you know, behave the way that they're behaving with, you know, relative impunity for their population. So we're seeing a little bit of a linguistic change. We are also seeing, you know, that the DNC had a meeting last week, and there was a resolution that was called to specifically call out AIPAC for the amount of money that they've put into races, you know, democratic races. And this is coming from right-wing sources, right? And that, you know, that resolution didn't make it. So I think that that says a lot about where we are right now. It's a moment of the ground is shifting. I don't know what the answer is going to be. I know what I think the answer should be.
Trump has also flirted openly with the idea of a ground war in Iran. And this has come at the same time that I believe it's the Department of Defense or Department of War has announced, I'm not sure actually which federal department, that all boys age or young men aged 18 to 26 who would ordinarily be forced to register for a potential draft because it's an age-old archaic thing will now be automatically registered, which raised a lot of fear in a lot of folks, parents in particular. Do you think we're going to end up at a ground war? Is it even possible to predict what this president is going to do? But it just seems so unimaginable that the U.S. would launch a ground war in Iran, a very, you know, organized, educated, powerful country that has spent years building its defenses because it's basically been in a semi-permanent defensive posture against the U.S. It just seems unimaginable.
I mean, from every possible angle, it seems unimaginable. I mean, from like the basic geography of Iran, I don't know, like, I don't know physically how they would plan on doing it. There's been
right. Of, it's, you know, a lot of water.
Doesn't really make sense. Yeah, a lot of water, a lot of mountains.
A lot of straits and, you know, narrow waterways that Iran controls.
Yeah, it's a bizarre proposition. I am shocked that we in 2026 are saying this and we're even debating this. Whether or not it will happen, I'm not sure. I will say that there's been, you see Trump making these kinds of maximalist demands, like, you know, saying that he'll commit genocide, essentially wipe the entire Iranian civilization off the map. And one of the things I do worry about, like for us here in the US, is that we are becoming so immune to anything that when he makes these demands and then he does something slightly less, we just kind of are okay with that. Even I feel like, you know, I was on social media at 8 p.m. on Tuesday last week when he was making that, you know, he said, you know, entire civilization will be wiped out, and he gave a specific time. And when it became clear there was a ceasefire, like, I just saw people just started talking about baseball, you know? So I think that there is, he benefits surely from this really short-term memory that I think the American public has when it comes to foreign policy. That said, I mean, one thing I want to say is that the place that is most kind of thrown out as a potential place where they would invade is this place called Kharg Island. Seamus Malik actually wrote a piece for us in Truth Out, you know, reminding people that, you know, several thousand people live on this island. Like, what do you do with them? So it's clear that the Trump administration hasn't thought about anything. Like, you know, they just announced yesterday that they'll blockade a blockade. Who knows what that means? So it's hard to take them. It's hard to understand or parse where things are going whenever they make these threats, but at the end of the day, people's lives are really at risk. So I am always going to be nervous about what he says.
And when asked about what his plans are, his cabinet will say things like, only the president knows what he's going to do next. And of course, it seems pretty obvious that even the president doesn't know what he's going to do next. He will allow words to slip out of his mouth and then figure out how to make them work. And then the next day say something completely different. It just is hard to fathom the place that we're at, and the fact that so much of what we're seeing with this war in Iran is wrapped up in the fact that this country is desperately in need of a change of leadership. And one of Trump's major allies, was defeated just this past weekend in Hungary. An authoritarian like him, Viktor Orban, was defeated by a massive democratic uprising in Hungary. That's not to say that the person they elected is necessarily some liberal left savior. But I'm wondering if we can finally end on this question of whether you think, if the Hungarians can do it, can the Americans? Not just for Iran's sake, but for everyone's sake.
I certainly hope so. I think there's, I'm glad that you brought up what you brought up, and that, you know, we have yet to see how Peter Magyar is going to actually govern. But I do think that there's a longer timeline that we need to be thinking about, those of us in the US, about what it takes to actually start to dismantle our militarism, like our addiction to militarism. I think that that's something that we need to be doing, and we can start doing it tomorrow. We don't have to wait for an election. We can start by pushing back when we see weapons manufacturers or weapons lobbyists, or, you know, people who are doing PR for these weapons companies, when they end up in our neighborhoods, because that's what they are. They, you know, they're all around the country. Like, I think we can be doing that. And so, you know, on an election level, I can certainly hope that we don't have someone as dangerous as Trump in the White House, that we have people who are in Congress who are willing to hold a president, regardless of who they are, accountable. But also, I think that we need to be doing a lot more beyond that to make sure that we are not putting other people in this situation ever again, the way that we're putting Iranians, Lebanese, Palestinians in that situation that they're in right now.
And of course, if we had an opposition party that was worth anything, they would be taking that media clip of Trump saying that, you know, we can't have Medicare and Medicaid because we're fighting wars. They would be putting that on repeat in ads around the country. But unfortunately, the Democratic Party has never been comfortable with an anti-war posture and an embrace of funding social issues. You know, meanwhile, we just heard Mexico under Claudia Sheinbaum has launched a universal healthcare program. And, you know, all these other countries have people who can have the nice things because they're more fixated on actually using people's collective resources to benefit them. But it's offering us an example of what we could have, don't have, and need to aim for. Nagin, I know you've written quite a bit in Truthout, where you're the editor-in-chief, about Iran, and we'll certainly link to that from our website. Any last thoughts? I know you said you have family in Iran, and imagine you're in touch with them. I can't imagine the stress you're under. I have family in the United Arab Emirates, who are, of course, also dealing with bombs that are being intercepted. And it's quite scary.
That's really what it comes down to, is that, you know, I think for all of us, like the aim for getting daycare and Medicare for all and all these things is really, it should be worthwhile. But, you know, Iranian life is just as precious as American life. And so I think I'd just love to leave your viewers with that.
Thank you so much for joining us, and best of luck to you.
Thanks so much for having me.
My guest has been Nagin Oliayi. She's the editor-in-chief of Truthout, an independent media organization providing reporting and commentary on social justice issues. And for full disclosure, I'm a Truthout contributor. You can read my work there as well as Nagin's. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar, host and executive producer of Rising Up with Sonali, an independently produced, subscriber-supported program nationally syndicated to radio stations, free speech TV, and podcast platforms. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar, host and executive producer of Rising Up with Sonali, an independently produced, subscriber-supported program nationally syndicated to radio stations, free speech TV, and podcast platforms. Our interviews are available to subscribers at risingupwithsonali.com. The New York Times on Tuesday published an editorial titled, "Here's How to Defeat Trumpism." The piece reflected on Peter Magyar's earth-shattering win over Viktor Orban in Hungary. Orban is a dictator Donald Trump has long admired. The paper maintained that, quote, "The Democratic Party's need to develop an ambitious agenda that goes far beyond criticizing Mr. Trump should chart an alternative vision for the country. And then it went on to denounce the, quote, social progressivism that dominates elite left-leaning circles and alienates many voters, end of quote. With such sentiments dominating corporate news media, a mass mobilization led by grassroots organizations aims to bring millions of people onto American streets on May 1st. The May Day Strong Coalition has a clear agenda, quote, tax the rich, no ICE, no war, no private army serving authoritarian power, expand democracy, and hands off our vote. Joining me to tell us more about it is Saqib Bhatti, co-founder and executive director of the Action Center on Race and the Economy. He works on campaigns to win racial and economic justice by taking on corporations responsible for extracting wealth and resources from communities of color and poor people. Welcome to the program, Saqib.
It's great to be here.
I'm wondering what you make of this argument that we hear over and over again. I mean, essentially, the left has been saying for a very long time, if the Democrats want to win, they need to go far beyond, we're not Trump, please vote for us, right? Hillary Clinton said, vote for me because I'm not Trump. Essentially, that's what Kamala Harris said. And neither of them articulated a clear agenda that showed how they would be different from Trump. And it seems as though the New York Times kind of got close and then backed away and talked about left-leaning, elite left-leaning circles. I've never come across such elite left-leaning circles. I don't know if you have.
I mean, I have. I think the New York Times is it, right? I think this is the key thing is that the Democratic elites, the party insiders, fundamentally fail to understand that everything that they have been doing is what has brought us where we are now. The fact that the Democratic Party turned away from working families, the fact that they chose to become the party of Wall Street and corporate America, fundamentally and just fundamentally ceded the working class to the right. Just played a huge role in the rise of Trump, the failure of Democrats to advance a bold agenda to actually that spoke to people's needs is what led them to turn to Trump out of desperation in many cases because they couldn't make ends meet. And that's what we're trying to do with May Day Strong is figure out how we're actually developing an agenda and fighting for an agenda that speaks to the needs of Black folks, Latinx folks, immigrants, working class folks, poor white folks. We know that we need to actually speak to directly to the economic interests of everyone in the country in a way that the Democrats have refused to do. And the New York Times has been a cheerleader in everything they've been doing up to this point.
May Day has traditionally been the International Day of Solidarity for working people around the world. It's a day for labor, organized and not. It's a day that has often been a holiday in other parts of the world. And it's a day that actually has a wonderful history here in the United States. But that has been erased for many decades now. Is the May 1st date deliberate? Is it significant as the day that you're calling this mobilization on?
Absolutely. May Day is International Workers' Day. May Day also is the day in which immigrant communities organized 20 years ago in 2006 and had the closest thing we've ever done in this country to a general strike and really shut things down and showed the economic power that people have when they come together. And so we're absolutely invoking that legacy to say that we want to fight to show that we will not stand by while Trump and his billionaire buddies turn our societies into a living nightmare, and that we will shut things down, cause real economic disruption, and hit the billionaire oligarchs in their pocketbooks if they don't back down.
So what exactly do you envision happening this May 1st? And how does it build on the national mobilization that we just had at the end of March, the No Kings rallies around the country and marches and demonstrations, which were actually the third under that banner? Is there a direct line or, you know, is it more independent? Put it into context.
Yeah, I mean, so we are partnering very closely with No Kings to make sure that we're building bigger and bigger. So on May Day, on May 1st, we're going to see people, you know, taking to the streets, marching. We'll see students walking out from schools. We will see a day of no work, no school, no shopping in many cities. And this is really about, you know, workers, immigrants, racial justice organizations, and communities showing that they will not allow business as usual for a system that prioritizes billionaires and repression over people. And, you know, it is a part of an ongoing campaign to build the power needed to stop authoritarianism that includes No Kings. And so we showed our numbers on No Kings. We need to show our power on May Day. We're asking people to step out of business as usual, which can look like no work, no school, no shopping, so the country can feel what it really looks like when we're not there, and so we can flex our power.
One of the issues that No Kings came up against was some critiques from some folks on the left who didn't feel that No Kings articulated strongly enough in opposition to war. You know, the Iran war had just been launched, and there was seemed also to be a little too much coziness in some parts of the or some local organization, some local organized mobilizations around No Kings with the Democratic Party. And of course, AIPAC ties, the link directly to Israel and the genocide against Gaza, the war on Iran. How valid are those critiques? And I know that the May Day Strong Coalition explicitly says no war and seems to have a little bit more explicit agenda.
Yeah, I mean, one of our three demands on May Day is no ICE, no war, no private armies for authoritarian power. We know that none of us are free until all of us are free. And we also know that allowing the genocide in Gaza to take place under a democratic administration greased the wheels for fascism domestically and for the wars we're seeing now in Iran and Lebanon, even the attacks on Venezuela. Made as Strong is calling for an end to the authoritarian takeover and illegal wars, both at home and abroad. I think that this is something that, you know, in the United States, we often, movement-wide, we have a tendency to work in silos. These are the economic justice folks. These are the racial justice folks. These are the anti-war folks. And one of the things that we all need to start doing a better job of is actually building bridges across those movements. And so, you know, with the partnership with No Kings and May Day Strong, we're hoping to move more in that direction. So the hope really is that, among other things, May Day will become the biggest anti-war demonstration in the history of the country.
Anti-war and also tax the rich, no ICE. Let's go through some of that agenda that is explicitly laid out, although I have to say quite succinctly, you know, it's hard to, of course, encompass everything that the left has desperately needed and wanted into a small, easy to read set of demands that fits on a placard, right? Like some might look at the tax the rich, no ICE, no war, hands off our vote, etc., and say, well, what about LGBTQ rights and marriage equality and the attack and transphobia? What about, you know, so how do you explain why these points have made it onto the agenda and not others? And, you know, climate crisis, etc., hasn't been mentioned.
Yeah, I mean, we need to fight to preserve all of our rights. We need to fight to make the Earth a livable planet. We know that those are essential to the well-being of communities all across the country. We're highlighting these demands of, you know, taxing the billionaires so their families come first, no ICE, no war, protecting the vote and expanding democracy and reigning in corporate power. We're focusing on those because we're looking at what do we think in this moment, where are the attacks the most, you know, where is the administration leading with the attacks? And what we're seeing is that they are shredding the social safety net. They are doing ICE occupations of our cities. They're launching wars, and they are trying to come for our voting rights. They're doing a lot of other things, but those are the three, the three-ish things they're doing that affect the largest number of people. And therefore, when we're thinking about how do we actually really show the depth and breadth of our resistance and our coalition, we need to figure out how we're actually speaking to the most people. So that doesn't mean that we're ignoring the other demands. Those are we need to protect reproductive rights, we need to protect LGBTQ rights, we need to protect the planet, we need to do a whole host of other things. We support all those things, and we're leading with these three demands as points of unity that can bring in the most people.
I'm going back to that New York Times editorial from Tuesday that I mentioned earlier. It's so interesting to see the way in which the paper suggests that the Democratic Party absolutely needs to rally around a clear agenda that shows that they go beyond Trump, and yet they suggest that, Peter Magyar of Hungary should be studied because he ran as an economic progressive and a cultural moderate, if not conservative. And this goes hand in hand with some of the critiques from centrist Democrats that say that, oh, the left is too woke. They've gone too far. They've, because they uplifted the rights of transgender people or undocumented immigrants, they lost the centrist voters, and they're the ones who led to the party's loss and led to Trump's rise. And it seems as though the Times is kind of reflecting the same thing. Meanwhile, just I believe some weeks ago, the Times surveyed a bunch of Democratic voters, had this interesting focus group, and every single person in that focus group essentially said that the Democratic Party wasn't left enough, and that they wanted a clear agenda that lifts everybody up. So it's just so interesting to see how the Times, just like Trump and his ilk, have tried to divide the left, right? Tried to say, well, we want, we should rally around this, but not focus so much on the rights of this community. And I'm wondering if you have thoughts on that.
I think the Democrats don't give voters enough credit. There are certainly there are folks who are racist, there are folks who are homophobic. But at the end of the day, most people that have decided to turn towards Trump, they do so because Trump has given them an explanation for why things are not working for them, right? If you're a poor white person, and you're looking for to understand why it is that you can no longer make ends meet, and Trump is out there saying, well, it's because of these immigrants who are taking your jobs, or it's because of DEI, he's at least offering you an explanation. And what Democrats are doing is just saying, oh, well, the economy is great, and not actually recognizing and speaking to the pain the people are actually feeling, while at the same time they're actually lining their pockets with campaign contributions from the very folks responsible for the broken economy that we have. Both Democrats and Republicans have actually tried to divide working class folks from, what they call special identity groups, but they've tried to divide us on racial lines, on lines of gender, sexual orientation, religion. We know that one of the ways in which the ruling class, both Democrats and Republicans alike, convince, say, poor white people to vote against programs that will actually benefit them, to vote for tax cuts for the wealthy, is by racializing these issues, by actually saying, well, no, do you really want to pay for, public schools in the inner city? Do you really want to, your money to go towards, Medicaid for undocumented folks, even though undocumented folks don't get Medicaid? We know that when you racialize an issue, that you can get poor white people to vote against their own economic interests by invoking their racial interest. And so it's not some pathology in within voters that prevents them from understanding that, or there's not some pathology in voters that just means that they're inherently racist, they're inherently homophobic. They often are turning in that direction because of the explanations that are being offered to them. And unfortunately, the Democratic Party has been spending too much time defending the broken status quo and protecting the corporations and the billionaires who have actually made their wealth off of by causing harm in working class communities. And that's what's forced people to act, or that's what's created an opportunity and opening for Trump and the right to actually offer their analysis of what's happening, which unfortunately doesn't bode well for the rest of us.
Right. So finally, Saqib, tell me how people can also look through and look up the real affordability agenda that Mayday Strong has put out. It's a report that can be downloaded, and how they can hook in to Mayday events near them. I imagine, like the No Kings rallies, there's probably tons of local events happening that, and if they aren't, people can organize them. There's a map, you can put your zip code and find, you know, when and where to show up. Are you also explicitly, I imagine, calling on people to potentially not work that day? So give us those critical details.
Yes, so we have a real affordability agenda, which is a concrete policy blueprint covering housing, wages, healthcare, education, and worker power, grounded in real wins from states that are already advancing tax justice. You can find the Real Affordability Agenda at our website at maydaystrong.org. You can also sign up to host an event at maydaystrong.org. If you go to the landing page and just scroll down a little bit, you'll see a map that shows you all the events that are already scheduled to take place. As well as a couple of links that allow you to host an action if there isn't one already happening near you. We know that the only way we're going to win the real affordability agenda is by holding the ruling class's feet to the fire. A big part of that is turning out on May Day. A big part of that is making sure that we're not just turning out on big mobilizations, but we're also staying involved in campaigns to build power and win the core planks of the agenda. And so we want to have campaigns to tax the wealthy. We want to connect this to work that's happening in budget sessions in cities and states across the country. We also know that we have to keep up pressure on the corporations, the billionaires that are causing the pain in our communities in between these big mobilizations. So we have a big day of action on May Day, another big one we're planning around Labor Day, but we also want to have a summer full of activity to help build up the pressure and fight for the real affordability agenda.
Saqib, thank you so much for joining us today, and we'll post all of those links from our website as well. Good luck to you, and I'm certainly going to try to be out there on May 1st talking to folks who have been, you know, taking the day off maybe and showing up for this real affordability agenda. Thanks so much.
Thank you. Look forward to seeing you there.
My guest has been Saqib Bhatti, co-founder and executive director of the Action Center on Race and the Economy, and I'm Sonali Kolhatkar, host and executive producer of Rising Up with Sonali, an independently produced subscriber-supported program nationally syndicated to radio stations, free speech TV, and podcast platforms. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar, host and executive producer of Rising Up with Sonali, an independently produced subscriber-supported program nationally syndicated to radio stations, free speech TV, and podcast platforms. Our interviews are available to subscribers at risingupwithsonali.com. More than three decades ago, a scrappy radio station, WBAI Pacifica Radio in New York, became the birthplace of Democracy Now!, a pioneering politics and news show that centered people over profits, human rights over advertisers, and justice over business as usual. The show, hosted and produced by Amy Goodman and a small army of intrepid journalists, broke boundaries, challenged corporate media, and is now the focus of a new documentary, Steal the Story, Please. The film, releasing in theaters nationwide, traces several milestones in Goodman's coverage, from the controversial airing of commentaries by political prisoner Mumia Abu-Jamal to a massacre in East Timor, the September 11th attacks and subsequent war on Iraq, through to the emergence of Donald Trump. Amy Goodman now joins me. She's an award-winning investigative journalist, author, and host and executive producer of Democracy Now!, which airs on more than 1,500 public television and radio stations worldwide. Amy, I want to begin by letting you know that when I first considered hosting a show on KPFK Pacifica in Los Angeles, it was listening to Democracy Now! That gave me the courage to do what I ended up doing. I listened to you and I figured out that all I needed was a thirst for truth and justice. So thank you for that. What is the title of this film, Steal the Story, Please Me? Let's start there.
Well, Sonali, it means so much to me that you said Democracy Now! Inspired you, because I respect your work so much, both on Rising Up and Uprising before that. Steal the Story, Please, is our motto at Democracy Now! We consider an exclusive a failure. We want the media to pick up our stories, steal these stories and take them out to the wider world in the same way that we don't expect people will just come to Democracy Now! We go out in all social media platforms, from Instagram to YouTube to X to wherever, to ensure that wherever people are, that's where we have to be able to get these different voices out.
So when you think about the lifespan of Democracy Now!, you know, going from, you've covered so many presidents, and most independent media has been kind of pushed out and, you know, have been at the margins. You've clawed your way into many places, but you've also happened to be sometimes in the right place at the right time. I'm thinking of the interview with Bill Clinton, who was calling in to the studios of WBI to get out the vote, not having any idea that he was going to encounter a real journalist and being asked questions that nobody asked him. And it seems as though a lot of folks in power are often so shocked when they get asked questions that actually cut to the heart of the matter, and that is really evident in the documentary Steal This Story, Please. Are you shocked by how shocked your subjects often are at never getting questioned, sometimes in the way in which you've questioned them?
Well, you give the example, and they show this in Steal This Story, Please, the interview with Bill Clinton on Election Day 2000. He wanted to call radio stations to get out the vote. I had preparation all of 1 second. They just called into our radio station. And as I say in the documentary, they said the White House is calling. I thought they said the White Horse is calling. The White Horse is a famous tavern in the village. It's where Dylan Thomas, I believe, drank himself to death. And they said, the president would like to talk to you. And I said, the president of what? And they said, the president of the United States of America. Oh, the White House, not the White Horse. And so we went on the air. And it was actually right after Democracy Now!, the Alternativa Latina music show. And so I did it with the host of that show. And then we ran it on Democracy Now! The next day. And I asked President Clinton about getting out the vote, why it was important, and then why he was, how he responded to many people saying he took the party, the Democratic Party, to the right. I asked him about whether he would grant clemency for the Native American leader, Leonard Peltier. I asked him about Israel and Palestine and sanctions against Iraq that had killed so many, and about racial profiling. So we had, to say the least, a robust discussion. And after about half an hour, he said he had to go. So I went back into the studio and into our offices, and the White House called and said they were considering banning me from the White House. I said, what are you talking about? He called me. I didn't call him. And they said, we told you he had a few minutes. You kept him on for over half an hour. I said, he's the leader of the free world. He could hang up if he wants to. So it was very interesting. And this really comes right through to today. And when you hear Palestinian child or an Israeli grandmother or an uncle in Afghanistan or an aunt in Iraq, you may not agree with them, but it may, maybe you identify your uncle with that uncle or your kid with that kid. It makes it much less likely that you'll want to destroy them. And that's why I think the media can be the greatest force for peace on earth. Instead, all too often, it's wielded as a weapon of war, which is why we have to take the media back.
Amy, the film also shows a little bit of the personal life that you've led, which I thought was really fascinating because, yes, you know, people watch the show, people listen to it, people get informed by it, but it's actual people putting this together. You know, Amy Goodman is a real person, not just a person, TV personality. You have a dog. Your dog is in the
And
film.
I have a real dog. Actually, a news hound, one of the leading paparazzi of our time.
And people can see that in the film, but also you dig into your family background and your personal history of how you came to do what you did, because your family history is very interesting. Your parents, your grandparents, you even go back to your roots in Poland and talk about the persecution that your Jewish family, that your family faced for being Jewish, and how that has informed that those teachings have informed your sense of justice. How important is it for people to understand this? Because it's, you know, it's not just, it's personal, right? This is personal for you. This is a labor of love. You don't do it for wealth and fame, because there's not much wealth.
That's absolutely true. You know, my grandfather, my mom's dad, was an Orthodox rabbi. He was the principal of the Crown Heights Yeshiva in Brooklyn. My father's grandfather was the Henry Street rabbi on the Lower East Side. My mother's father was Orthodox. My father's grandfather was Hasidic. And my great-great-great-grandfather, probably needs a few more greats, was the Baal Shem Tov, the founder of Hasidism. And I was steeped in a Jewish education, as were my brothers. And, you know, and also the stories of what happened to our family. My grandparents were able to make it here. They fled the pogroms of Russia and Poland and what's now Ukraine. But many family members did not make it. And I really took to heart the idea that never again means never again for anyone, anywhere. I went to Hebrew school through high school, and I was always kind of obsessed, I guess you could say, very taken with non-Jews who would risk their own lives or their family's lives to hide a Jewish kid in a barn or a family in an attic or in a basement. I thought, why would they risk their lives? And I was always so deeply touched by that altruistic, humanistic act. And I think about now how important, when we look at what's happening in the world, that is something that has always inspired me. And that's what I took. It's not only from my Jewish education. I think every religious tradition values that, you know, Muslim, Christian, Hindu, agnostic, atheist, that humanistic tradition, how we have to care for each other, which is why it's such an honor and why I was so drawn to community radio, the community in Pacifica Radio and community television. And I think all media must build community.
Well, let's watch a short clip of the trailer of the documentary, Steal the Story, Please. It's been directed by Carl Deal and Tia Lesson, executive produced by Jane Fonda, Tom Morello, and Rosario Dawson.
Hi, I'm Amy Goodman from Democracy Now! Right. Can you tell us what you think about President Trump saying climate change is a Chinese hoax?
I'm sorry, I'm running late for a meeting. Thanks.
Right, but you weren't running late when you're just standing there, so...
My first impressions of Amy.
What did you say to those who say that you're a war criminal?
Man, she doesn't care what anybody thinks.
Well, don't push me. I'm a journalist here. Independent media is the oxygen of a democracy.
What do you mean by independent?
Not being sponsored by corporations.
Amy's chaotically brilliant at the spy game.
We began on 9 radio stations.
If she believes something, she's going to fight for it and get it out to the world.
And that's a short excerpt of the trailer of the new documentary, Steal This Story, Please, featuring my guest, Amy Goodman. Finally, too many independent journalists are struggling to simply have the resources to do the work that they do. And of course, digital technology makes it so much more possible today than 10 years ago or 20 years ago. Many have relied on the generosity of foundations, of individual listeners and viewers through pledge drives. But I'm wondering if you could design a democracy where the media was thriving and could hold government officials and corporate elites accountable. What would you like to see? Because, you know, the foundations can be flighty. People are struggling to make ends meet and never have enough money to donate to their favorite media institution. What would be the most sustainable way for an independent media universe that was covering all of the stories Democracy Now! Is covering?
Well, you know, Sonali, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, CPB, was founded in the 1960s. Bill Moyers was in the White House with Lyndon Johnson, but it was activists who recognized how hyper-commercialized the media had become and that there needed to be a space on the dial, we called it then, for educational television and radio. And that's what the Corporation for Public Broadcasting did, provided support for these stations in addition to listener and viewer support. Now, the Trump administration has eviscerated, has zeroed out the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. We no longer talk about CPB. We talk about CBP. That's Customs and Border Protection. And that's a huge problem as we talk about the immigrant crackdown. I think a lot of stations are going to go down as a result of this. As we show this film, and I should say it's the directors, I didn't make this film, Tia Lesson and Carl Deal, amazing Oscar-nominated, Emmy Award-winning directors, formerly Michael Moore's producers. As this film goes around the country, we are doing fundraisers for KPFK, for KPFA, for KPFT. We just finished one for WBAI, and we'll do them around the country for community radio, for stations endangered by the lack of funds. Looking into the future, I don't know what form media will take. You have the legacy media being sliced and diced. Jeff Bezos, founder of Amazon, has just cut the Washington Post newsroom by a third. It is absolutely astounding. The Middle East division almost gone when you have the U.S. and Israel attacking Iran. Actually, we had a Washington Post reporter on recently, and she did a whole analysis of the bombing of the primary school, girls' primary school in Manab in southern Iran, where more than 175 people died, vast majority girls, on the first day of the attack. And she did an analysis of this, but she wasn't doing it for the Washington Post anymore because she'd been laid off. It's just so unacceptable. We need a media that's funded by, and I hope that's what this film Steal the Story, Please, provides a model for listener, viewer, reader support for the citizens, and I mean citizens of the world, to support a media that is essential to the functioning of a democratic society.
Amy Goodman, thank you so much for all you do and for joining us today. Again, that website where people can find out where to watch the film Steal the Story, Please, in theaters is stealthestory.org. And you can, of course, find out about Democracy Now! At democracynow.org. Amy, thank you for everything you do and good luck with the film.
Sonali, thank you so much for everything you do.
My guest has been Amy Goodman, award-winning investigative journalist, author, and host and executive producer of Democracy Now!, subject of the new documentary, Steal the Story, Please. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar, host and executive producer of Rising Up with Sonali, an independently produced subscriber-supported program nationally syndicated to radio stations, free speech, TV, and podcast platforms. We'll be right back.
Hello, I'm Ian Masters, the host of Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org and heard on KPFK Mondays through Thursdays at 5 p.m. and on Sundays at 11 a.m. Background Briefing looks into three or four of the important stories and issues of the day to provide an in-depth daily briefing with context, history, and insight from the best-informed guests closest to the scene, who offer analysis and details often overlooked by the soundbite-driven media more and more controlled by Trump-friendly oligarchs. So if you want facts and information to inform a motivated majority to save our democracy before it's stolen next November, tune in Mondays to Thursdays at 5 p.m. and on Sundays at 11 a.m. for your Background Briefing here